Part 7. Malafrena. Chapter 1. When the Aesna post was on time, which it sometimes was, it came into Ereme, a junction point, at about 4 in the morning, some 20 hours out of Krasnoy. Passengers for Aesna need only be roused by the changing of horses, and then went on as before, briskly, over level roads. Passengers for the Montena had to get out in the cold darkness or colder dawn and change to the waiting Montena diligence. If they were new to the journey, they looked at the outlandish vehicle and asked with misgiving, "Is this the Portacheca coach?" If they had previously travelled in the southwest, they merely sighed and made ready to endure. 4 shaggy horses, short in the barrel and powerful of shoulder in the traces. A boy of 9 or 10, with a shapeless hat and a contemptuous eye, mounted the wheeler. A tall, dark man, whose mouth seemed to have rusted shut, letting out only monosyllables in a flat, unanswerable voice, got up to the box and said not "get up," but "hoy" to the horses, and off the Montena diligence would go, jouncing and jolting on a rutted road, its back to the sunrise, towards the mountains that rose blue and forbidding from the retreating night. On the morning of August the 20th, 4 passengers made the change, stumbling through the half-light from the big coach to the smaller one, amongst horses being led about, mail bags being transferred, and other obscure hurly-burly. "Is this the Portacheca coach?" one of the 4, a young woman, asked the driver with misgiving. "Aye," he said flatly. San Giusto handed her in, and soon they were off, with a snarl from the coachman's horn, a shout of "hoy," and a groaning protest from every joint of the vehicle, soon to be echoed silently in every joint of 3 of the passengers. The 4th one was under 2 years old, and light enough to find the jolts and lurches entertaining. The young mother and San Giusto promptly went to sleep again. Itali and the baby waked. The baby played with the bundles piled around him and with bits of straw from the floor that had got within his reach. He gazed about him often with a thoughtful and unhappy air, but made no complaint. The air was misty grey and very cold. Itali sat huddled, his collar up round his ears, and his hands in his pockets. Ever since Saint-Lazare, where he had suffered from cold more than from any other misery, he felt cold easily and dreaded it, but had no resistance to it. So he sat now, huddled up, trying to keep his teeth from chattering. To keep his mind off his discomfort, he watched steadily out of the narrow slit of front window, through which he could see the wheelboy's hat and the sky, and when the road turned that way, a glimpse of peaks ahead. Day came fast. Now the round hills to either hand brightened with the morning sun, the clear light of a harvest day in the high country. The hay was long since in, the grain coming in. In fields far off on the hillsides, Itali would see a line of mowers, the tiny glint of lifted sickles. When they passed through villages or past estates, small freeholds with the house set near the road, white and red hens cackled away from the wheels, dogs ran out and barked till the coach was out of earshot. Over the hills in the sun, sometimes a hawk circled, lazy in the dry blue air. Ahead, seen only at the crests of the long climbs, the mountains rose up from behind the yellow hills. Itali remembered how, years ago now, he had pulled out his watch to check the hour that he first lost sight of those mountains. 9:20 of a September morning it had been. He recalled the hour, though not the date. He had been on his way to Solareye, and from Solareye in time to Krasnoy, and to Esna, and to Eston, and to Rakava, to the dark, cold room where he had been chained to the wall, to Rook Square at dawn, and Ebroye Street in the smoky evening. And now he was come round full circle, and even so did not know where he was going, or where was any place he could with a clear heart call home. He felt for his watch, but did not have it. He thought he'd lost it, then remembered that since it no longer ran, he had left it in his room at Carante's flat. The police probably had it again by now. Let them have it, he thought. San Giusto sighed in his sleep. Though a farrier in Fontanasferay had set and splintered his hand, it continued to give him a great deal of pain, and he slept when he could. Propped up in the corner across from him, the young mother also slept, her childish, round face curiously stern. Her child, beside her, had slid down uncomfortably among the bundles and was looking unhappier. Itali looked away from the child guiltily. It was going to cry, and it would be up to him, being awake, to do something about it. Sure enough, the baby gave a series of gasps, preliminary to the howl. He looked very sad and helpless. He stared straight at Itali and gasped more loudly. Itali returned his look uneasily and said in a low tone, "Don't do that. You'll wake up your mother." The eyes filled immediately with tears. The small face went all into folds, and the baby gave a piteous wail. "Damn," Itali said, and reached across, picked the baby out of the nest of bundles, and set him on his knees. He was startled at the lightness and fragility of the burden. Really, there was not much to a baby. The baby gasped a couple of times, then settled down with a sigh, like a tiny echo of San Giusto's, put his thumb in his mouth, and fell to playing with a button of Itali's coat. What did the mother call to him? Stasio. Stasio's father died, she had said to someone in the Esna coach last night. In June, the consumption it was. Itali felt a touch on his hand, the faint brush of the child's hand. Not the young man's name, nor my husband, but Stasio's father. All the dead man's life was that now, his fatherhood. Stasio discovered the top button of Itali's waistcoat and fingered it delicately as a miser with a jewel. He sucked his thumb, and slowly, with many starts and little movements, dropped his head down against Itali's coat and fell asleep. He had been cold, Itali thought. He was warmer now, in the shelter of Itali's arm, and could sleep. Itali no longer gazed ahead at the hills, but down at his little transitory charge. The child's hair was brown, very fine. Itali touched it very lightly, thinking of his friend Egon Brunoy. Brunoy's hair had been brown like this, but coarse and dry. Itali tried to recall Brunoy's face, but could not. He could rouse no reality of memory, only a dull regret and a dull shame. He thought of Isabel, and his mind, as always, flinched away. He thought of Frenin, of Karante, who was hurt or dead or jailed. But from that, too, his mind flinched away. To Brelave. But the thought of Brelave, in the dark, cold room, chained, was unendurable. His hands clenched, and he had to control his sudden tension lest he waken the sleeping child. But the list would be finished. Amadei, dead. And then last, and unexpected, for he'd never thought of her as a friend among his friends, Louisa. Unkind, unforgiving, and unself-forgiving, loyal. And like the others, self-betrayed. And betrayed, like the others, by him. By his desires and her own. And their hope, by their love. Where he had most passionately set his heart and mind, he had done injury. And the worst injury, the worst betrayal, was the knowledge of it. His arm grew cramped, but he did not move, lest he wake the child. At last, he too dozed off. In mid-morning, the coach stopped in a tiny village. Itali handed Stasio over to his mother with relief, and rubbing his numbed arm, climbed out of the coach with San Giusto. "Bara already?" "Aye," said the rusty coachman, not uncivilly, for his passenger had said the name of the village with the broad Montana accent. "We're on the border," Itali said, coming over to the roadside where his friend stood stretching and yawning. "Walk over to where that pig's rooting, and you'll be in the Montana." They walked in the bright sunlight down the rutted streets of Bara, and patted a dog that came up hungry and fawning. Neither had anything to say. They turned back to take some breakfast at the hovel that called itself, in faded letters and obscure picture on a sideboard, The Traveller's Rest. While the peasant girl, left in charge of the place, was fetching bread and cheese, Itali looked about the room, at its dirt floor, dirty walls, benches, table, and out of the door, onto the bright, desolate street, where the mangy dog sunned himself, and nothing else stirred. The child, who brought them sour wine, she'd only gaped when they asked for coffee, had a neck thickened by an incipient goiter and a dull way of staring. He had forgotten that dull look, that country look. He sat down at the table to drink his wine and picked up a couple of printed sheets lying on it, left by travellers. One was the broadsheet of a song such as mountain peddlers sold or gave with their wares. The other a handbill, which he started to read without recognition. Revolution, it was headed. On the 27th of July, the citizens of Paris rose in the name of the French people to protest. He read no further, though his eyes found the line at the foot of the sheet. August the 13th, 1830, from the office of Novesma Verba. San Giusto had wandered over, chewing on a hunk of bread. Itali left the handbill lying, got up and went out. He stood there in the sunlight and looked at the hut opposite, with its clumsy door and oil-paper window, at the pig rooting in the street by a pump where the dust had turned to mud, at the white dog cringing. At the poor, short length of the village, where the coach loomed on its high wheels, taller than the huts beside it. Behind the huts, and before them, the streets became again the high road, the road he must follow, that had brought him so far here. "The horses are in. I suppose we leave soon," said San Giusto, coming out beside him. Itali turned away and set his hands against the wall of the traveller's rest, hard, as if to push the sorry little house down. He felt the hot, dry clay under his palms, the heat of the sun on his shoulders. "Here I come to ground," he thought. "I thought I must succeed, because my hopes were so high. And I have failed. I thought I must win, because my cause was just, and I have been defeated. It was all air, words, talk, lies, and the steel chain that brings you up short 2 steps from the wall." For 5 years, he'd been sick for home, and now, forced to it as a fugitive, he must come to it knowing that he had no home. Slowly and steadily, the little horses pulled. The coach jolted on towards the mountains that now dominated all the lower sky. After the midday stop at Vemari, they still had to climb 2,000 feet up and some 12 miles on, winding now more south than west. The air grew yet more clear and dry, the mountains darker blue, the cricket chant on the slopes deeper and more long drawn out, and the boy, riding the wheel horse, pulled his cap down over his eyes and sang, half-dozing, the song that seemed as monotonous and timeless as the cricket song. "Grey will fall the autumn rain, sleep, my love, and sleep thee well. My heart has broken and will break again. Sleep till thou wilt waken." "Don't pester the gentleman, Stasio." "Oh, that's all right." "It's too good of you, sir. You come here now, Stasio." "He's all right here." Itali let the baby investigate his waistcoat, grateful for the distraction, seeing always the mountains rise around him. The road wound in and out. The young mother looked down the plunge of a ravine to the right and shut her eyes. "We'll be out of this in a couple of miles. Then there's a straight pull to the pass." They were going at less than a foot pace now, the tough little horses straining, the wheel boy wide awake, the driver's whip crackling lightly over the horses' necks. "What mountains are those, if you don't mind, sir?" "The mountains above Lake Malafrena." "Hoy there! Get on! Get on!" "Now we tip over?" San Giusto inquired placidly of fate. The coach righted itself and settled back into the ruts. The little horses pulled sturdily. Declining, the sun shone to their right, and the long shadow of Sinvia Mountain stretched up the forested slope of San Giovanni, like a barrier before them, dividing the mountain valley from the open golden weather of the hills. "This is like my own country," San Giusto said. His voice was soft, yet there is no one thing the same. After a while he said, "So I come here with you after all." Itali nodded, dodging the memory of Easter in Aesna. But it would not be dodged, and he said at last, "I wish I had thrown it over then, gone home, before I went too far to be able to come back." San Giusto glanced at him calmly and keenly. After a time he said, 5 or 6 months is not long enough. One comes back, Kitali. But what does one bring? I don't know. I was a fool before I... or before that. Now I'm wise. Now I know what a fool I was, right? But what use is wisdom? What good is it? When the price of it is hope. I don't know. San Giusto replied again, very quietly and with humility. Itali caught himself, was ashamed, and was silent. He would not talk again. The habit of protest was strong, well nourished. But it was time to go back to the older habit, silence. Stasio had wakened, whimpering among his bundles again. And Itali picked him up, set him on his knee, let him play with the endlessly wondrous waistcoat buttons, while sunlit and shadowed slopes closed in on the road and the horses quickened their pace. The road levelled out. Porta Ceca lay before them in the pass, greeted by the wheelboy's long whistle. Porta Ceca. Peaked roofs. Streets of slate stairs, twining between crowded houses. The monastery of Sinvilla, frowning over it, white, on the dark mountain shoulder. The Golden Lion, where as a child, Itali had watched the high coaches roll in, dusty, come from remote and unimaginable lands. "Where to now?" asked San Giusto, when they were standing on the cobble street, since Itali, looking bewildered, made no move. "I don't know. I hadn't thought to..." The innkeeper's wife was coming out, peering curiously at them. "Come on, this way," Itali said, and set off abruptly, leading San Giusto down a long slate stair, across a little street, through a back alley, and up another set of stairs to a garden gate. There he stopped. "Itali," said San Giusto, who had also been making decisions, "this is your family, and you are unexpected. I shall put up at the inn and meet you when it's convenient." Itali looked at him with some angry bewilderment. Then he laughed. "You can't," he said. "We haven't got a kruna left. Come on." He pushed open the gate, and San Giusto reluctantly followed him up the path, between phlox and pansies, to the door. To the little servant girl, who went rigid with dismay at the sight of strangers, the stiff, neat, high-windowed parlour, the grey-haired woman who came in looking puzzled, and then looked frightened, and putting her hands to her throat whispered, "Itali, oh mercy of heaven, Itali." "I'm sorry, I'm sorry," Itali said, as she embraced him. "There was no way to let you know. I'm sorry." "You're so thin," she whispered, and then, releasing him, "It's all right, my dear. I was startled, but I don't faint, you know." And already she was turning to San Giusto to welcome him with the fine courtesy and profound distrustfulness of the Montana. Taking his hand and repeating his name as Itali introduced them, inviting them both to sit down, ascertaining that they were tired, hungry, dirty, and looking after their needs. Not a word came from her that could distress Itali after the first cry. Only she asked in her blunt way, when he had given a sketchy explanation of why he'd arrived so suddenly, "Then, how long will you stay?" "I don't know." His tone cut her off, and she asked nothing more about his plans. Nor did Emmanuel at first, when he came home to find the little maid in a flurry, his wife preternaturally calm and ironical, and his bedroom, bath, razors, and clean shirts, sacrificed to the unknown foreigner, an unexpected nephew. "When did you leave Krasnoy?" was his first question. "Tuesday." "What's going on?" "The post didn't come last week. Still no papers on the diligence." "They weren't printed." "Why not?" Emmanuel exploded. And a summary of the days of the insurrection only enraged him. "You mean that never a word of all this reached us until you came here? Good God! We might have been a kingdom for a week and never known it." "But we're only a grand duchy," Itali said. "So it doesn't matter." "Look here, Uncle. I want to ask you. I want to go on to the house to see Mother. But I can't. I don't know what my status is. I've been prescribed from Krasnoy, but it may go farther. I don't want..." Emmanuel interrupted him. "What difference will that make to them?" "I don't know." "What are you talking about?" "I'm talking about my father." "Yes, you're right. He ought to be prepared a bit for this." "I came here because I had nowhere else to go," Itali said, going dead white. "But if there are going to be any conditions, any accusations, I'll go on now, across the border." San Giusto, coming in from the other room, stopped in the doorway, a towel around his bare neck. "Oime," he said to himself, and withdrew. The uncle and nephew stood face to face. "You damned arrogant fool," Emmanuel said. "Who said anything about conditions and accusations? What I'm talking about is that Guide is ill and needs a bit of protection from shocks."
"Ill?
Since November. Why do you think it was I that came to the Sovena, not he or Eleonora?"
"But you said then..."
"He told me to say as little as possible about it to you. I obeyed him. I've always done what Guide says. Maybe I was wrong, I don't know. He was ill again about a month ago. I wanted to write to you. They both said not to. I could have come..." "What good would that do?"
Itali sat down on the bed. He was still very white, and there was a forced rigidity in the way he held his shoulders and arms that made Emmanuel realize at last that he was very near breaking point.
"None," he said.
"He's all right, Itali. No worse than he was now. It's the same heart trouble. It can go on for years like this, you know. I didn't mean to alarm you, but you cannot walk on him in anger."
Itali shook his head. "Emmanuel," said Perneta, outside the bedroom door, "if you'll ride on out to the lake and tell Guide and Eleonora we're coming, I'll give Itali and his friend a little supper and put Allegra in the gig, and we'll come along in an hour or so."
"Right," Emmanuel said.
He turned back to Itali, wanting to say something more, to reassure him, but he did not know what to say. The relation between Guide and Itali, the bond of absolute loyalty, strained impossibly by competitive pride, the understanding and hostility, the vulnerability of each to the other, all that was beyond Emmanuel now, as always. Whenever he came close to that passionate and essential relationship in either the son or the father, he burned his fingers in the fire of it, fumbled, lost his temper, guessed wrong. And yet, it was always he who had to bring the news to Guide. He thought as he saddled his horse and set off through lengthening shadows towards the lake. Always he who was the intermediary. 30 months ago, he had been driven down here to tell Guide
that the boy had been arrested and jailed, and had gone about it all wrong, jabbed his clumsy fingers into the wound. This time, he had badly misunderstood Itali, when all the young man was doing was clinging desperately to the last fragments of pride. It was always pride with these two, their strength and patience, their violence and vulnerability, all came down to pride, to the resistance of the will, to the insults and indifference of time. Resistance, never acceptance. They gave with open hands, but they had never learned to receive. Guido's somber temper had turned ardent in the sun, but the root of it still was pride and pain. The world is a hard place for the strong, Emmanuel thought. It gives no quarter. No man ever defied evil and got off lightly. He hoped to find Guido alone, but saw him with Laura in the garden behind the house. To judge by their gestures, they were discussing replantings, and they did not see him coming down the road till he was at the fence. Then Laura looked round and came alive. "There's Uncle. Was there a letter?" "Oh, aye," he said, smiling. It would have been so easy to tell Laura his news. Why was it so hard to tell Guido? "Panita's coming along behind me. Will he give us dinner?"
"Of course."
"But where's the letter?" "I haven't got it, niece." Laura looked at him, alert and silent. "It's a message rather than a letter. Itali wants to know if he can come here, Guido." "Where is he?" "In Porta Ceca, at the house. Came in on the diligence this afternoon with another man." Guido stood still. Laura did not speak. "What brought him here?" "He has nowhere else to go. He came with the clothes on his back. There was a revolution in Krasnoy. The assembly's been dissolved, but there was fighting for 2 days. He's under ban and doesn't know how far it extends. You must let him come without questioning him, without conditions, Guido. He's lost everything he was working for." "Conditions?" Guido said. "Tell your mother," he said to Laura. "I'll go to Porta Ceca." He was out of the gate and coming round past Emmanuel to the stables as he spoke. "They're probably on the way already," Emmanuel said. And seeing there was no stopping Guido, "Here then, take the horse. He's fresh." He dismounted. Guido swung up and was off. Laura, looking after her father, trembled all over and laughed. "How strange it is, you riding up there, while we were standing here talking about the hollies, and the house, and the road, as if it had happened before. I was standing here, and you rode up to tell us he was coming, as if there was only one moment, and this was it." "Where's your mother, lass?"
"Indoors."
They walked. She on this side of the picket fence, and he on that, back to the gate. Laura went lightly, hurrying. Before going in, she looked back once at the garden in the clear light, the rises, the empty paths. When they came, she was confused. She had forgotten Emmanuel had said there was a stranger with Itali. She could not tell which was her brother, as the gig came out from under the oaks in the late dusk. She went forward with her mother and uncle. She felt herself moving over the short grass in the warm twilight air. A tall man jumped down from the gig and came to them. That was his blue coat. It was Itali. When she held him in her arms, he was as thin as a child, but his face was a man's face now. Was this her brother, who was the other man, with his hand tied up in a bandage, holding back from them. "Welcome home," she said to him. And after a moment he smiled. Someone else laughed. All at once she was happy, caught the moment passing never to return, was herself, and the waiting was over. They were home. "Come in. Come into the house," she urged them. The father, brother, stranger.